Hey, CE Plan members from CE Impact, this is Game Changers. I'm Jen Moulton, and with me today, I have not one, but both of our favorite contributors, Drs. Jeff Wall and Jake Galdo. My job today is going to be moderating these two and keeping them on task and focus. So it's not a small job, but it's my job today. So hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Okay, so you've already got us on focus, Jen. You hardly had to do anything, and here we are.
I know, and here we are. It's like, where do we go next?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so here's where we're going next. Today's topic is a big one because the whole world, I think, is talking about this and hoping that we see some relief for patients. But we're talking about the rate of inflation and drug prices and what our government is trying to do about it. So Jake, I am going to turf it to you to get you to get us started on this topic because it's a big one. So we want to jump right in today.
Awesome. Thanks, Jen. And thanks, Jeff, for tag teaming this with me. You'll find out why very, very shortly. So we are recording this on April 1st, so April Fool's Day, and March 26th. So all of 5 days ago, the Department of Health and Human Services did a new announcement saying that they are updating the Inflation Reduction Act rebate program. So this is our big drug pricing thing that happened with the IRA, which is kind of a big deal. Like, this is the major legislation that we've seen with this, one of the major legislations we've seen come out in the last couple of years. And it really focused on drug pricing, because that's what we always talk about. We always talk about the cost of drugs, cost of drugs, cost of drugs. Candidly, though, if you hear Jen and I talk about this, we'll highlight the fact that health inequities cost more than the cost of drugs. And I'll also point out that the hospital system, I'm sorry, Jeff, is actually more expensive than the cost of drugs.
Yes,
so
indeed.
Even though we're going to talk about the cost of drugs, I think it's very prudent to highlight that drugs are not the driver cost of healthcare expenditures. The number one driver of healthcare expenditure is hospitalization and hospital costs, which include drugs. I'm not going to forget that, but just generally speaking, anytime we talk about drug pricing, I think it's fair to point out that this is the thing that we as patients experience, but it is not the ultimate driver of healthcare expenditures. Regardless of all of that, we now have this Inflation Reduction Act that is allowing the federal government to negotiate and manage with drug pricing, which is a big deal. And so in March 26, HHS did this big announcement, and they are adding 41 drugs to a new rebate program based off of 45 HPIC codes. We'll come back to that in a second. And what's very interesting about this, so that was March 26. Starting today, April 1st, it's going into effect. So they did not give a lot of leeway whatsoever with this initiative.
Yeah,
and
plus
everything
a holiday weekend.
Right, really, the holiday weekend, lots of things going on.
It's the beginning of the month.
By the way, your pricing
Monday.
Is changing. Yeah, right, so many little things. So starting today, new pricing is going into effect, and they look at it on a quarterly basis. So everything that we're talking about is for the April 1st to June 30th quarter. And this evaluation of pricing is based off of the rate of inflation at the US level versus the rate of price increase for the drugs. There's this 20% threshold. So 20% is kind of normal, quote unquote, which I don't know whenever 20% was normal. I'm going to say none of us here have probably ever received a yearly bonus or a yearly pay raise of 20%. And I'm saying that knowing that I used to work closely with Jen. So Jen, I'm really sorry for saying that out loud. But like, we talk about the rate of inflation, 20% seems kind of crazy to me.
Yeah. Well, that would be my wish, right? Jake, to be able to do that.
But, right. We would want to do that. We want to do that. So we just need to negotiate drug prices with everybody, and then we can get that 20%.
Yeah.
But this
we're being California and what was
exactly.
that today too,
yeah.
right? Goes into effect. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything's changing today.
Minimum
it's not
wage.
A joke.
Yeah.
And so it's going to impact 750,000 people. So over 750,000 Medicare beneficiaries are on one of these medications, one of these 41 medications, and the anticipated savings to the individual is anywhere from $1 to $3,575, which is a crazy spread, per dose. This isn't per month. It's not per year. It's per dose. Again, some of these medications might be dosed once a month, but again, it's kind of interesting to see that there's this reduction in price anywhere from $1 to $3,500. And so how does this ultimately work? Drug companies are going to have to give their rebate for the drug pricing based on that 20% threshold back to Medicare. that Medicare payment is going to go towards the Medicare trust fund. So, you know, we talk about trust fund babies. Apparently, Medicare is a trust fund baby, and it's going to be funded by part of these rebates. All of the rebates are actually going to be retrospective for 2023 and 2024, and that the government will not be invoicing the drug companies until no later than the fall of 2025. Nobody's going to see this on their bottom line right now, but it's forthcoming. And so this is kind of happening. And so, you know, we see that the government announced this. We started to understand how it's going to work. And then I got to the section where it talked about the drugs, and I was really excited. And it said, we will be focusing on Part B, as in boy drugs. And I went, well, this has absolutely nothing to do with me. Maybe I should call Jeff. Because as some of you might remember, Jeff and I talked about this topic a year ago when we talked about the IRA first doing drug rebates, and it was for oral agents. It was for Part D drugs, something that we see in the community pharmacy setting. And so, you know, I got really excited. This talked about the expansion of medications. I was like, awesome, what are the new ones? And then they said Part Boy. And I called my friend Jeff and said, what's going on? So Jeff?
Yeah. You know, and I had read the blurb, but Jake, I hadn't done the detail as always you're really good at doing. But yeah, I mean, that was definitely the first thing I saw, was that unlike the first 10 drugs, which, I mean, definitely, you know, had both, you know, big DOAX on it, had, you know, had an SGLT2 drug, if I remember right, on the original list of 10. I mean, medications that are definitely in the top 50 prescribed and dispensed medications in outpatient settings in the United States. There are some of those here, but it is far more targeted in two areas. One is medications that are almost always just given in the hospital setting, but also a large number of direct targeted oral chemotherapy agents. And so I think that was some of the big differences. And certainly the relief in the latter, the relief in the direct targeted therapies is huge, because as everybody knows, those drugs are, you know, thousands of dollars a month. And you know, I read a statistic last year or the year before, that, you know, said something like 70 to 75% of all patients who take these direct oral drugs are on some sort of patient assistance program, whether it's, you know, helping with their coinsurance, because most of these drugs are so expensive, they don't even count for a copay. So you'd end up having to pay 10, 20% of the drug. So with, you know, coinsurance, copay, total pay, something along those lines. So the vast majority of people are already getting a little bit, and I emphasize or a little bit of help with some of these oral direct targeted agents. And so the fact that, you know, in general, as Jake pointed out, I mean, there's some variation, but on the whole, about a 19% decrease in cost will help, I think, everybody along the line. And so, yeah, so that, I think that is, if you are, you know, suffering from cancer, or know somebody who is, or as a family member, you know, these direct targeted therapies have largely become the standard of care in so many different areas of cancer, so many different types of tumors, that a 20%, you know, decrease in overall costs should help insurance companies with that price, and then hopefully decrease the co-insurance or the copay that a patient has to pay. Because again, most patients now with any, especially any sort of solid tumor, breast cancer, urinary tract cancer, lung cancer, they're all going to be on these direct targeted therapies. So I think that's, you know, an area that kind of crosses, you know, the world of Jake has and outpatient pharmacy in my world, though a lot of these drugs are so expensive that regular outpatient pharmacies can't even carry them. They have to be in specialty pharmacies. So, but then you get into the inpatient setting, and I have to admit, I was kind of surprised by some of the drugs here. Some of them, you know, are notoriously expensive in an inpatient setting. For example, argatroban, which is a drug that's the only FDA approved drug for heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. Though frankly we cheat and use things like fondapyrinux sometimes, but it is the only drug, and it's notoriously expensive, somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500 a day for treatment. And the fact that there's about a 17% decrease in one of the brands is again, I think, will help, you know, the bottom line of a lot of hospital pharmacies, and as well as hopefully eventually pass, you know, that savings coming down to the patient as well. Several of the older drugs for acute rejection injection, Atgam, and a couple other of these medications is also on the list. Not, I mean, expensive as well, but not nearly as expensive as, for example, some of the direct targeted therapies that we were talking about. There was a 16% decrease in the long-acting forms of penicillin, the bicillin injection. I don't know if those of us who are more veteran people out there may remember when you were little kids and you had you were sick and your parents brought you to the doctor and they gave you like a single shot. They didn't give you antibiotics. They just gave you a shot of penicillin in the butt. That's what those are. We use them for things like syphilis and stuff today. I didn't realize it was that expensive. Then I did a look. And I mean, while they're not nearly as expensive as, again, these more modern direct targeted therapies, they're several hundred dollars a shot. And I did not realize that. I would have thought that these long-acting penicillin derivatives would have been really inexpensive, about a 16% drop in that. Some other medications, there's a couple of drugs, more modern drugs used for the treatment of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, especially the aprepitant derivatives, the NK1 receptor antagonists, have long been known to be really expensive. When I talk about treatment of nausea and vomiting, I always note that, you know, even the generic versions of some of these agents, though they're oral, are actually pretty pricey. The discount isn't quite as high on these medications, but the fact that they're on the list at all is pretty interesting. The hypergammaglobulin for tetanus, which I have only seen ever used once in my life, thank goodness, because people do tend to get their tetanus shot. It may be one of the few vaccines that it doesn't have a garner a lot of controversy right now. So that's, you know, that's about a 20% decrease on that. Lupron Depot, that's another big one for prostate cancer, usually like late stage hormone sensitive prostate cancer, about a 20% drop in that. So I thought that was pretty good. And then surprisingly, they go into antibiotics somewhat. Two of the big ones that I noted were Vabomere. Vabomere is a carbapenem drug derivative that's actually FDA approved for carbapenemase resistant organisms. So you're talking about, you know, KPCs or CRE type organisms that are traditionally resistant to just about everything you throw at them. They're gram negative organisms, Enterobacter, stuff like that. I'm fortunate enough that I live in a part of the country that I almost never see these, but certainly if you practice on the coast, if you practice in Chicago, Detroit, you're absolutely going to see those bad organisms. And these newer antibiotics, you know, are just, they're hundreds of dollars a day, you know, whereas, you know, a day of ceftriaxone is like 50 cents, you know, a day of even a more powerful antibiotic like, you know, Zosyn or Meropenem is only a few dollars a day. So the fact that some of these newer antibiotics that are, you know, $400, $500, $600 a day, it really puts a strain on a lot of inpatient costs and things like that. So, you know, that there's about a 20% decrease in that, which is nice. Tigecycline, which is a tetracycline derivative used a lot for, you know, it can be used for MRSA, it can be used for some weirdo gram negatives that are super resistant. It also made the list with about a 10% decrease. And then I think the last one that I think affects both inpatient and outpatient is Prolia. So Prolia, as people know, it's a ligand receptor that's used for osteoporosis. But it's also used for hypercalcemia malignancy. And that's where I see it used in the hospital in a patient who can't tolerate or is not a candidate for an intravenous bisphosphonate. Prolia is kind of the second line drug that can be used for hypercalcemia malignancy. I actually had a case of that just two or three weeks ago. We had a patient who had severe renal insufficiency, was approaching dialysis, and came in with a calcium of 16 with symptoms of hypercalcemia. And the nephrologists were extremely reluctant. The patient wasn't on dialysis yet. They were extremely reluctant to give the patient an intravenous bisphosphonate. We can certainly get into a debate about whether or not that's, you know, those drugs are truly dangerous in that population. But the fact was the nephrologists just weren't having it. So we actually gave a dose of Prolia, and it worked actually pretty decently in about the same time frame, in about 2 or 3 days. And again, Prolia is used outpatient as well, as we all know, for osteoporosis. So, I mean, I think that you know, there's a big difference here, obviously, from the firsthand drugs. And I agree with Jake that, yeah, there's a lot of medications that are going to be more in my realm than his. But I think, you know, there's definitely going to be relief for a lot of cancer patients, that, you know, that there's going to be some decrease in their coinsurance or copay, their copay. I'm hopeful that some of the drugs here, which have you know, a notorious reputation for being pretty expensive, that will take you know, the pressure off the directors of pharmacy when they're looking at their budget, so we can use these drugs a little more frequently. So that's kind of where I'm at, Jake. I mean, and as you noted, you know, when I started reading up for this and I saw Part B, I mean, yeah, the light kind of flashed in my head and went, Part B, you know what, you know, sort of thing. So, you know, and of course that means using J codes and stuff like that. So I don't know, you know, what's your take on that?
Well, I think what's interesting is that there are 41 unique drugs, but 45 J codes that they're kind of going off of. There's one or two C codes in there as well. I think what's most interesting to me when you kind of walk through the list of medications that you covered with us is the number of either manufacturer-specific agents. So like tigecycline, they're calling out specifically the Accord derivative, or with, you mentioned, ergatroband. They have two, and they said that they are not therapeutically interchangeable, one by Accord and one by Aromedics. So I thought it was really interesting that some of the drugs, it's just like all medications, and then others are just like only these by this one manufacturer. So I thought that was kind of a salient kind of call out. You know, do you have any insight? Because I have no idea, Jeff.
I think it brings the other question is, I mean, looking at the kind of wide ranging selection, and I'm sure there are people, you know, in CMS who, you know, I mean, well, I'm sure there's lots of people in CMS, but I think there's a lot of, you know, way more smarter people than I am that are sitting down and looking at programs and looking at forecasting models that says, okay, you know, why did we pick these 45 drugs? Because I can tell you, while these are some common drugs for certain types of cancers, for example, I can count on two hands the number of times I've used ergatroband in the last 12 months. We just don't use that much because HIT isn't all that common anymore. So, you know, stuff like that, there's definitely some, you know, some of these drugs, for example, nausea and vomiting, some of these antibiotics. The Verbamir is a good example. I mean, you know, yes, if you practice on the coasts or some other big cities, you're going to use a little bit of this drug. But again, you know, even in hospitals where CREs are relatively common, bottom line is that 90% of people are not going to need them. We're still going to use good old fashioned, you know, ceftriaxone, good old fashioned, you know, piperazone, stuff like that. So, you know, they did pick drugs that were expensive, but they didn't pick drugs that work, I think, in most hospitals in common use. And as you point out, they did pick drugs that had J codes attached, which, you know, if I had a dollar for every time a rep was in my office saying, great news, Dr. Wall, our super expensive drug that you don't want to put on formulary here at your health system, we got a J code for it. And I'm like, uh-huh. And so, you know what that means? And I'm like, uh-huh. You know, and they're like, well, that means, you know, Medicare is going to pay most of it and it's going to be great. You know, and you know what I've tried to explain to you know reps before on this is that, you know, that's all terrific, but because of the siloing of healthcare, our director of pharmacy isn't going to get a pat on the head saying, well, you know, you're using this unbelievably expensive drug, but fortunately with the J code, we're going to get 90% of that back instead of 60% of it back. It doesn't matter. I mean, the bottom line is that you know we're going to get graded on how expensive the drug budget is, and so. You know, I wonder if that this selection was done, you know, semi-scientifically, but largely because these were all Part B drugs. So it comes from a different pot of money than the Part D drugs do. And I suspect that even though these aren't the more common drugs that have J codes associated with them, I suspect that they were drugs that were costing CMS an arm and a leg for whatever reason. And though they literally looked at the two different brands of ergatroband and said, okay, brand A is you know, the charge on, even with the J code, is X, and brand B is Y. And that's why we're going to pick, we're going to pick these versions, and we're going to pick that discounting, because the discounting is significantly different. One's almost 20%, and one's only about 4%. So I suspect that's what happened. I'd like to think it was a little more scientific than literally throwing, you know, darts at a wall saying, oh, okay, well, it hit our ergatroband, so I guess that's the one we're going to use. So, you know, so yeah, and clinically, no, there's no difference. Clinically, ergatroband. So, yeah, so.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I really like how you kind of broke that down, because I mean, that's some of the stuff that jumps out to me. And to your point, I bet it was a little bit more evidence-based driven, not an evidence-based that we think in healthcare, but evidence-based from a financial kind of data informatics, in the sense like when we looked at the Part B drugs, they were very mindful not to be lopsided on any one life science company.
Right.
And so if they did an SGLT2 from life science company one, then they didn't do a DOAC from life science one A as well. They would change it up. So I think that, you know, to your point, that might kind of play around with it. So I guess one last thing that kind of jumps out to me, and I'd love your kind of insider thoughts on it, is there is a stark amount of antibiotics. And, you know, we think about antimicrobial resistance, we think about antimicrobial stewardship, and we think about the fact that there's not new antibiotics coming out. And oftentimes there's not new antibiotics because everybody says there's no money there. And this is not going to be a commentary on the R&D of a medication, so we're going to ignore that aspect of it. So the other thing that we hear about antibiotics, though, are drug shortages. And forgive me, but I feel like penicillin was a shortage recently, yet I see the branded penicillin long-acting on this list. So any thoughts on how those factors might play into this pricing strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jake. And yeah, I mean, you know, for a while there, you're right, while we were unable to get the I mean, not depot, but long acting, you know, injectable versions of penicillin. The CR formulation and for a while was pretty much unattainable. And, you know, and if you work in an emergency room, you know, where they're treating, you know, STIs, they were really having to kind of hop around and do some other things using alternative agents. But as far as I know, those are kind of back on the market. The problem is, you know, with several of these medications, especially the generic ones, and again, Bicillin, you could argue whether it's generic or not. But I mean, when you're kind of the only game in town, one wonders, you know, if a drug has a history of shortages, if you already all of a sudden tell a company, you know, okay, well, you know, we're now going to pay you 20% less for that same medication. I mean, unlike what you see a lot on social media, I don't think that drug companies are quite that nefarious. But I mean, you do wonder if they're like, well, you know, we're not going to put that much, you know, we're going to put less effort into a product that is just frankly less profitable. I mean, you know, can we put more effort into making sure the supply, you know, line of, you know, Y, you know, drug as opposed to X drug is going to be stable for a long period of time. Again, I don't think that would happen on purpose. You know, I just, you know, it's, you know, not to quote the Godfather. I mean, it's just business. It ain't personal sort of thing, but I do wonder if that is going to happen. Obviously that won't happen with the really expensive chemo drugs because, you know, the profit on those is so much higher than with generic medications that I suspect that these companies can absorb that 20% hit, you know. I mean, that they're not going to be happy about it, but they're certainly not going to be a losing proposition for them for these medications just because the profit is just so incredible. So yeah, I think it has the potential in drugs that have already been shown to have large shortages to potentiate that. But I think for most of the, especially the direct oral chemotherapy drugs, I doubt it'll have much of an effect.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just jumping in and at the risk of, you know, sending this conversation for another 2 hours, because I think we could talk about this forever. But, you know, Jake, your comment at the beginning about, you know, the cost of drugs. I mean, this is one way to tackle it. I mean, we've got, you know, you talk about drug therapy problems, which, you know, was related to the hospitalizations you mentioned. But I mean, I think that is more than two times now the cost of the actual drugs. So that's a big issue that I would love to hear either of your feedback on. And then of course, you know, we all things go back to the PBMs. You know, I don't think we want to go there today. But again, like the cost of drugs per se is really coming from a lot of other places besides the tangible drug.
Right.
So, you know, I appreciate that we're, you know, trying to address this issue, but I mean, in all reality, like those other things I feel like would be more impactful. And this is kind of a low lift.
I mean, yeah, I agree, you know, and Jake, I'm sure can speak 100 times more eloquently than I on, you know, the evil that is PBMs. Notice that nobody else is laughing because, you know, they totally agree with that sentiment.
I'm muted for that. But yeah, also, just the drug therapy problem. Like, can we, right. pay pharmacists to manage that, which needs right. to be managed? And, you know, we're just putting all of our money to the drug.
Right. I mean, you know, a good example are STIs. You know, I mean, I think that there's been some success in HMOs of having a pharmacist run STI clinic, right? That, you know, basically, you know, a patient goes to their primary care doctor or an urgent care, an ER, and does in fact get diagnosed with an STI, and, you know, the pharmacy clinic is next door, or they've got a agreement with a small independent pharmacy that they basically, you know, have the medication on board, give the medication to the patient if it's a single dose, which it often is, you know, kind of direct observe therapy. They take it right then and there, and then follow up with them in a week and say, you know, how are you feeling? You know, are symptoms getting better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, that would absolutely increase compliance. That I think it would probably do a good job of educating patients on more safe sex practices during the treatment of those STIs. It probably decrease transmission. So, I mean, yeah, I think that there's absolutely some examples of that, especially pharmacies. Try to do as good a job as they can with these unbelievably expensive chemo agents monitoring patients for side effects, of which there are, you know, some very bizarre ones. You know, yeah, people don't throw up and their hair doesn't fall out and all that stuff that we usually associate with chemo, but make no mistake, they still have some pretty bizarre side effects. So monitoring, I think, is worth it too. So, I mean, Jake, I mean, in your world, is that I know it's feasible, and I know you have the talent and the skills to pull it off, but like everything else, you know, show me the money, right?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately this goes back to the role of the pharmacy, and I'm pivoting us, right? We're talking about the IRA for drug costs in health systems, but to Jen's point, we spend twice as much money on inappropriate use of medications than we do on appropriate medications, and that's more of the outpatient data that we're looking at. And so this whole idea of medication optimization, making every encounter count, making sure the right dose gets to the right patient for the right reason, which is the bare minimum that we should be doing in a community setting, in any setting, because that's our role as a pharmacist, translates downstream so much. And so ultimately, I think what's an interesting kind of aside or thought process here is, don't cut the reimbursement on drugs, pay me more for the medications, but pay me relative to my ability to make sure it is the right medication and optimized medication, right? So you're paying for quality at a pharmacist and pharmacy technician intervention side that does drive down overall healthcare costs. So, you know, it's stop looking at pharmacy and medications as a cost center and look at it as an investment into lowering healthcare costs. Obesity therapy. We can get somebody to lose some weight, then that drives down their sleep apnea, it drives down hospitalizations, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, and the list goes on and on and on. Heck, some of the studies now show that our GLP-1 drugs used for weight loss address gambling, because it's the addiction that's happening, right? So think about the impact of a person with severe mental illness that goes bipolar, that goes into like a gambling binge and totally ruins everybody's lives. What happens if we give them a GLP-1, now they're not gambling, right? The ROI is there, but we sometimes don't look at it that way. We just say, it's expensive, I don't want to do it. Right. Yet the overarching ROI is truly there for a lot of these therapies in the outpatient setting.
Yeah, the direct line isn't there necessarily. You can't see the direct line. Yeah. Yeah, such a good point. Okay, well, anything, again, we could talk about that forever, so we'll just leave it at that. Jeff or Jake, anything else to wrap up on this topic? It's a big one this week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really hoping that now that the low-hanging fruit may have been selected by CMS, I can tell you, I could list you half a dozen drugs that I use far more commonly than the ones listed on here that are still real pricey. You know, I mean, they're pricey as many of the medications on this list, that I hope CMS turns their attention to them as well. And I think I can make a far better economic argument for using some of these medications if I can say, hey, look, you know, I know that, you know, not only does we have a J-code payment, but it's going to take 20% off the top with rebates of the cost to the hospital pharmacy. I think that will, you know, let up the brakes a little bit when we want to use these medications. So I'm hoping for that. Whether it happens or not, who knows?
I think for me, the last thing that I would highlight is that this is all part of the Medicare Part D quarterly sales pricing. this data is publicly available. One, if you like data, you can play with it. But two, you don't need to have only a 5-day notice that this is about to happen. So you can go to that quarterly reporting, you can pay attention to these trends and you know, do data-driven decisions at your health system on what to stock or not stock and how to manage things.
Yeah, really good point, Jake. Yeah, thank you. Because sometimes it does feel like, wow, this just came up, but they've been talking about it for a long, long time. And you have to, takes a little time, but you need to stay in those circles so you know what's coming. We can react to it a little bit quicker. Yeah, great point. Well, thank you to you both. Big topic, and that's it for this week. So if you are a CE Plan member, be sure to claim your CE credit for this episode by logging in at ceimpact.com. And as always, have a great week and keep learning. Thanks to you both. We'll talk soon.